Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Andres Arauz, Senior Research Fellow with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who describes the coup that overthrew Bolivia's socialist president Evo Morales, Latin America's first indigenous head of state. Celia Bavier of the humanitarian aid group No More Deaths, who talks about the Trump Justice Department's prosecution of Scott Warren for providing humanitarian aid to migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border. And Rebecca Burns of In These Times magazine, who discusses her coverage of the 11-day Chicago teacher strike and how the union's bargaining for the common good could be a harbinger for change within the U.S. labor movement. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In Argentina's mountainous Patagonia region, home to the indigenous Mapuche people, fracking wells dot the harsh landscape. The land shook on September 14th when a fracking well exploded and burned for 24 days, releasing natural gas and other toxic elements into the air. According to the Guardian newspaper, fracking accidents occur regularly in Vaca Muerta, one of the world's largest shale oil and gas reserves. In 2018, the area experienced over 900 fracking incidents. Local residents complain of leaks from wells resulting in water pollution and illness, including cancer. Moreover, livestock from the indigenous community are dying in surprising numbers. However, Argentina's leaders boast the shale boom will revive the South American nation's ailing economy through partnerships with energy giants like Chevron. The indigenous Mapuche people claim the fracking wells have only brought them poor health, discrimination, and dispossession. Indigenous leaders say they were denied land rights on the plateau, where they have grazed cattle and goats for a century, the same land where 500 fracking wells now operate. In early 2019, the Trump administration laid out its strategy to deny China's pick to lead the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, based in Rome. In the spring, as the U.S. and European Union split over which candidate to back, China's candidate, Ku Dongzhu, captured a majority of votes to lead the FAO. The U.S.-backed candidate, Georgia's former agriculture minister, David Kovalitsi, came in third. China's win over the U.S. and the EU is testament to the nation's rising influence at the UN. The Trump regime has pared back its funding and clout at the United Nations, withdrawing from key UN bodies. China has stepped in to fill the void, securing broad support for the crown jewel of President Xi Jinping's foreign policy, the Belt and Road Initiative. Foreign Policy magazine reports that of the 15 specialized agencies at the UN, Chinese nationals now head four of them. France, the United Kingdom, and the United States each lead one, though the three Western powers continue to hold monopolies on the most influential UN jobs overseeing peacekeeping, humanitarian relief, and political affairs. In April, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee put together a blacklist of campaign consultants who are working for insurgent Democrats challenging incumbents. In These Times magazine reports that the Democratic Campaign Committee's directive stated that any consultant, polling firm, communication strategist, or field operative that helped insurgent challengers would be ineligible for future work with the DCCC, practically forcing them to steer clear of any insurgent if they ever wanted to work on a Democratic congressional campaign again. One of the early victims of the blacklist was Marie Newman, who is running a progressive campaign against anti-choice conservative Democratic incumbent Representative Dan Lipinski in Chicago. She supports reproductive rights, Medicare for all, the Green New Deal, and a $15 minimum wage. After losing to Lipinski in 2018 by just over 2%, Newman could be poised for an upset over Lipinski. Newman is out fundraising the incumbent and could benefit from higher turnout of infrequent voters in a presidential election year. Longtime Chicago Observer Dick Simpson says a Newman victory could unleash the energy of grassroots activists to take on entrenched incumbents inside the Democratic Party across the country. Newman is now working with Justice Democrats who played a key role in Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's surprise 2018 primary win in New York City. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After 3 weeks of sometimes violent protests that left three dead and many injured, Bolivia's president Evo Morales was forced from power in a coup. On November 10th, Morales, Latin America's first indigenous head of state, and his vice president Alvaro Garcia announced their forced resignation and fled to the city of Cochabamba in central Bolivia. Morales later traveled to Mexico, where he's been granted political asylum. Protests followed the October 20th national election, which the Bolivian opposition had charged was manipulated by electoral authorities, to declare Morales the first-round victor. The Washington-dominated Organization of American States had published a report alleging irregularities that impacted the official vote count. But analysis by the Center for Economic and Policy Research has cast doubt on those findings, warning against what it called the politicization of the electoral observation process. Both the commander-in-chief of Bolivia's military and head of the Bolivian police requested in no uncertain terms the resignation of Morales. The coup forces, led by pro-Santa Cruz Committee President Luis Fernando Camacho, continues to target Morales's Movement for Socialism Party activists, progressive social movements, and the majority indigenous peoples of the nation. Your reporter spoke with Andres Arauz, senior research fellow with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a former minister of knowledge in the Ecuador government, and former central bank general director. Reached in Mexico City, where he's pursuing a PhD in economics, Arauz describes the actors in the coup that overthrew Bolivia's socialist president.
Now, this has led to a power vacuum in Bolivia. The vice president also resigned in solidarity with the president. So the line of succession is broken because there is nobody to be in charge of the presidency of the Bolivian government. And the congressional authorities that were supposed to be lines of succession have also resigned due to pressures from the opposition. There is apparently the second vice president of the Senate, an opposition leader. She is supposedly next in the line of succession, but the opposition protesters that have been leading the coup, especially Camacho from Santa Cruz, has said that somebody else needs to take in charge, and of course he's volunteered himself. Now, he's a person that is extremely right-wing. He belongs to Nazi groups in Santa Cruz. He is also part of the commercial and economic elite of Santa Cruz. He's a landowner. And he is what you may call a religious fanatic by, for example, taking the Bible and putting it on top of the Bolivian flag when he took over the presidential palace. It is expected that even if he's not actually in charge of the presidency, he may be the one actually running the country right now. Of course, he has no democratic mandate whatsoever. He was not elected at all, but he's the one exerting power right now. And he has asked the military that had not participated in any way by repressing protesters till today, he has asked the military to intervene and to exert force against the leftist campesinos that are now protesting against the coup d'etat, that are primarily from the countryside and from the Bolivian city of El Alto, which is just outside of La Paz, the capital city.
Andres, what do we know about any U.S. support for this apparent coup d'etat in Bolivia?
Well, there have been some pronouncements by the Trump administration congratulating the opposition forces for quote-unquote democracy. I don't know what kind of democracy there is. If everyone won the last elections, we may question whether he won by the just enough margin for a round, so for a second round, not to be necessary. But it was obvious that he had more votes than Mesa, even the OAS electoral supervisory mission admits so. We have also had some announcements by Marco Rubio, by the Attorney General, by the U.S. Attorney General, and of course by Mike Pompeo, all congratulating the Bolivian opposition for this. So even if the U.S. doesn't play an active role, which has been constant in the case of Bolivian history for the 20th century, throughout the 20th century, even these words that are encouraging the Bolivian coup plotters perhaps were not necessary in a civilized 21st century democracy.
Andres, who would the potential winners and losers be in a civil war in Bolivia that pits the indigenous population that supports Evo Morales and his MAS party against the regionally centered conservative opposition groups?
The Bolivian campesinos and indigenous majority has lived under repression from right-wing forces and conservative politicians, not in the last 24 hours, but more something like the last 500 years. Please recall that Evo Morales was the first indigenous president in an overwhelmingly indigenous majority population. So this is the first indigenous president in an indigenous country. And Evo Morales is really more like the figure of Nelson Mandela, who has been imprisoned for multiple times before he was ever a candidate or a politician, precisely because he led resistance against neoliberal or right-wing governments throughout the 20th century and the early 21st century. So, like even Evo Morales said, and his vice president, García Linera, the indigenous peoples are actually used to being the underdogs, are used to being the ones that are repressed and that face, the armed forces in very asymmetric terms. So it is widely expected that unless there is a democratic revival in Bolivia, the right-wing forces will, again, with the support of the armed forces, the police, and so on, will regain the upper hand and control with brute force the political situation in Bolivia. In economic terms, it will mean an aggressive extractivist project primarily based on the expansion of the agriculture into the Amazon. Camacho is a landowner that supports expansion of the agricultural frontier into the Amazon, having devastating ecological consequences. And of course, in the macroeconomic side, there is no doubt that a right-wing government would simply adopt the IMF agenda, which is clearly set out for Bolivia in its last report from December 2018.
That was Andres Arauz, senior research fellow with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and Ecuador's former Minister of Knowledge and Central Bank General Director. Find more analysis and commentary on the Bolivian coup by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Suffering and death at the U.S.-Mexico border is hard to fathom for those who don't know what the desert is like. Thirst, intense heat, stings from poisonous scorpions, and exhaustion have led to 3,000 immigrant deaths in the Arizona border region since 2000. 6,000 more across the entire border region from California to Texas, plus an estimated 4,000 people who've died in the desert but whose remains were never found. Humanitarian aid groups have been deploying emergency supplies of water, canned food, clothing, and other survival items along migrant trails for decades. In early 2019, four volunteers with a group No More Deaths, No Más Muertes were convicted of multiple misdemeanors for providing emergency supplies to migrants. Earlier in January 2018, Federal authorities arrested another No More Deaths volunteer, Scott Warren, and charged him with 2 counts of harboring migrants and 1 count of conspiracy. They also arrested the 2 immigrants whom Warren had given the humanitarian aid. His trial in June ended with a hung jury, 8-4 in favor of acquittal. But in July, the Trump Justice Department decided to retry him, dropping the conspiracy charge. If convicted, Warren faces 5 years in prison on each count of harboring. His second trial began on November 12th in Tucson. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Celia Bavier, fundraising coordinator with No More Deaths, who discusses Scott Warren's case and the larger story of the life and death struggles on the U.S.-Mexico border.
We've gotten a huge amount of support. We've done a huge canvassing campaign for the last, well, almost basically year leading up to the trial. And we did that to reach out to people and just let them know about the trial and the conditions along the border and about the work that these humanitarian organizations that are doing that's so important. And we've just received an overwhelming amount of support by canvassing door-to-door, people putting up signs, people writing letters to the editor, showing up at the courthouse. Nationally, we've received a huge amount of support. We had 133,000 people sign a petition back in June to support his work, saying that humanitarian aid should never be a crime. We've got the United Nations to submit a statement, Amnesty International, and 15 senators signed a letter in his support and in support of other humanitarian aid volunteers. So, yes, I mean, we've gotten just a huge outcry. And fundraising has increased, too, because of that, just showing the support. So the new trial starts Tuesday, November 12th. We expect it to go about 2 weeks. We have people going out to the desert every single day to weave water and food and medical supplies. And we have a couple of more organized days, I guess you would say, where we have people like out of town, visitors that will be joining them, people that might not normally do that. They'll be coming into town to do that. And we will be having a Faith Floods the Courthouse day on Wednesday, November 20th, where we'll have faith leaders from across southern Arizona, but also from across the country, come into town to give support from the faith community. One of Scott's defenses in the case is that he is acting on his strongly held religious beliefs to do this work. So that is a component of the trial. And he has obtained huge support from faith communities of different types across the country.
Celia Bavier, when these humanitarian groups started ramping up along the border around 2001, volunteers were finding hundreds of migrants a day in need of help. And now, with all the Trump policies in place to discourage migration, the numbers have plummeted. How common is it to find migrants in the desert these days?
We're out doing humanitarian aid every day. I can't honestly tell you how common that is. I know it's happening continually. People are crossing over only because we have a search and rescue group who gets calls every day, as does the Pima County Sheriff's Department. They get calls every day from people that are lost or from their families who are calling them from their countries of origin saying that we have not heard from such and such since this date, and they are either lost in the desert trying to cross over, or they are lost in Mexico getting ready to cross over, or they are in the detention system and lost. So while you're right, I think the numbers may have gone down in terms of people crossing because people are being held in Mexico and all that, people are also just continually trying to cross. And because they're being held in Mexico, I think this is just anecdotal evidence at this point, but we think people may try to cross over more. That migrant protocol policy, has not happened in Arizona yet. So as of right now, in the border crossings here, migrants are not kept in Mexico officially like they are in Texas and California. But if and when that changes, you know, the whole migration pattern could change as well. Because if people are forced to stay in unsafe places in Mexico, they're more tempted to just try to come over on their own instead of waiting for that official hearing.
Any last thoughts on Scott Warren's trial?
Our big fear is if he's convicted, it will have a chilling effect on giving aid, not just along the border, but in many circumstances to people that are undocumented or uncertain status. and we have to help all people in need, whether they're in the borderlands or not. And if Dr. Warren is convicted, it will act as a deterrent to people helping those in need, and then more people will be suffering and dying in the borderlands.
That was Celia Bavier, fundraising coordinator with the group No More Deaths. Learn more about Scott Warren's case and groups working for his acquittal by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When 32,000 Chicago public school teachers and aides went on strike in the nation's third largest school district with 360,000 students on October 17th, there was broad public support. The first major walkout in the city since a strike in 2012 came after 10 months of talks with Mayor Lori Lightfoot failed to resolve differences over pay and benefits, class size, and a demand for fairly compensated school support staff. The teachers' union also demanded the city launch a program to expand affordable housing. After 11 days on the picket line in the rain and snow, teachers returned to school on November 1st. The strike had succeeded in winning teacher pay increases and an agreement to place a social worker and nurse in every school. However, the union failed to make progress on their demand that the city initiate programs to expand affordable housing. Your reporter spoke with Rebecca Burns, contributing editor at In These Times magazine, who discusses her coverage of the Chicago teachers' strike and how the union's focus on social justice issues affecting their communities, known as bargaining for the common good, could be a harbinger for change within the U.S. labor movement.
So this is the longest teachers' strike that Chicago has seen in decades, longer than the landmark 2012 strike that the Chicago Teachers Union went on. And they were campaigning for a number of issues that related to classroom learning conditions, so things like class size, and also issues that kind of spoke to broader issues facing students, so staffing for social workers, nurses, counselors. And finally, I think the strike was really unique and avant-garde in that, the Chicago Teachers Union has been a proponent of what's called bargaining for the common good, or sort of an orientation to contract negotiations that really brings in the concerns and the issues of the broader community. The teachers union was also pushing affordable housing as one of its contract demands in a way that I think we haven't seen in quite some time, and that really sort of started conversations here in the city. And I should note, one of the other things that was really notable this time around was that it was not just the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union, that was on strike, but another union, SEIU Local 73, that represents janitors, bus aides, special education assistants.
And Rebecca, as you talked to union members after the strike concluded, were they satisfied that their time out from work was worth the effort, worth all the organizing that they'd been engaged in for months and months? Did they feel the outcome was worth their effort?
Yeah, well, I think there are sort of two parts to that answer. The first is, yes, definitely. I think people are incredibly proud of the fact that they won, really for the first time, a guarantee that by 2023, every school will have a nurse and a social worker. They won, I think the average was 40% pay bumps for paraprofessional staff who, in many cases, are making poverty wages, as well as pay bumps for special education assistants and other support staff who 2/3 of their children qualified for reduced lunch because of the low wages they were making. So there were significant gains around issues of staffing, to a lesser degree class sizes, also bilingual education and special education that really clearly wouldn't have happened had these unions not gone on strike. So that's the first part of the answer. The second part that I think strikers are very much cognizant of is that these still are really basic guarantees that a lot of, in Illinois, suburban school districts already enjoy. You know, just asking for things like a nurse in every school really seems sort of so fundamental that I think even at the same time that people are proud of the strike they went on, there's sort of some reflection on why it took that kind of sort of monumental effort just to win those basics.
At the outset, Rebecca, you mentioned that the Chicago Teachers Union had not only campaigned for internal issues related to their day-to-day work in the school system in Chicago, but also on a common good agenda, a social justice mm-hmm. agenda for Chicago and the communities that they live in and teach in. And this was a departure from most union organizing these days. It may have been that unions took on these bigger social issues back when unions were in their heyday, and certainly in the 30s when organizing was met by armed force and repression, but that hasn't been the face of labor unions for quite some time now.
That's right. You know, the CTU's 2012 strike really helped sort of spark the wave of both more militant teacher uprisings that we've been seeing, as well as sort of a renewed orientation among a lot of progressive unions towards this idea that bargaining is, you know, not just about pay and benefits, but an opportunity to raise these broader social issues and to sort of wield the power that unions have to try and address them. So, you know, a really concrete example is that, you know, Chicago, like many other cities, doesn't have rent control, in part because of a state law that preempts cities from legislating around this issue. The Chicago Teachers Union sort of took the opportunity of its contract negotiations to essentially urge the mayor to support the push for rent control and to urge Chicago Public School District to support the push for rent control, highlighting the ways that, you know, the issues of affordable housing and homelessness, there are 17,000 homeless students in the Chicago school system, you know, how those really related fundamentally to issues that teachers see in the classroom every day.
That was Rebecca Burns, contributing editor at In These Times magazine. Find links to her coverage of the Chicago teachers' strike and related articles by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, Pocket Casts, Castro, CastBox, Podchaser, and dozens of community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.